Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm Sophie Reynolds and today I'm speaking to Lucy Bailey about her upcoming production of The Winter's Tale for the RSC, which is currently in rehearsal and will open in Stratford at the end of January. So Lucy, let's dive in right at the beginning. We're going to be talking about the first act of the play. And traditionally, I think the first act of The Winter's Tale is fairly muted, you might say, by comparison with the sort of the colourful riot of Bohemia that we get later on. Is that true, would you say, in your production? Or tell me about how you start the play.
Well, my instincts were probably exactly the opposite. I suppose I read the play and having sort of understood the play very much in those terms, that it moves from, you often see the play, at least in my memory, moving from a more sort of reasonable, rational, colder world to something that is more fecund and joyful. And that tends to be the passage of it. But when I read it, I thought, oh, it's actually not exactly the reverse, but the beginning is, of course, the idyll, not the pastoral in the middle of the play in Bohemia, but the Cecilia has to begin as an idyll. So I've sort of, in fact, when I get to Bohemia, we go into the opposite. We go into quite a gloomy sky and rainy scene and quite bitter cold. It doesn't mean the people are, but my contrast really had been between a world that in Cecilia is privileged, is inward-looking, is removed from the people, removed from what's going on around them, beautiful and, in a sense, its own little paradise, but is also fragile and temporary. Whereas when we reach Bohemia, it is people who are having to make the most out of absolutely nothing.
Right. And tell me about your setting for this production. Where, I mean, you mentioned that it's sort of rather a lovely, idyllic place, but how have you set it?
Well, I've always felt when I read it that it's not two places. You know, it's not a literal piece. Bohemia and Cecilia are not, in Shakespeare's mind, yes, of course, they travel to go between them, but in one sense it's more a metaphor for states of mind. In Cecilia, he's looking, as I said, at the societies that have a lot of money and wealth and, in a sense, complete security. So there's no military in Cecilia or Bohemia. We never come across soldiers. In some ways, there has been, it feels, for some generations, total peace, and that's given it a kind of false security. So in looking at a world that is actually divided not by really where they are, but by who they are and what they have. So in Cecilia, money, just be really crudely simple, and in Bohemia, you have not. And in Cecilia, you have blue skies and blue sea, and it's, life is an endless summer's day. And in Bohemia, it's rainy and there's very little sun. It's probably, I've set it on the northwest coast of England, just to sort of root it. But really, again, the central metaphor of the set is not that. It's actually just the top and the bottom of a tower. So we've seen the Sicilians as living in their own ivory tower, at the top of a tower where you really literally don't see below, and Bohemia is on the grimy beach at the bottom of the tower, struggling to keep alive, really, for survival. And out of that struggle for survival, of course, comes immense humour and a less self-conscious sense of joy when they get the moment to party.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they get the moment to party one day a year, so to speak, I'm being a bit extreme, or a week a year, as opposed to the people at the top who get the chance to party.
Yeah.
A lot.
So they really make the most of it and they enjoy it, whereas...
Yes, whereas for the top it's a status quo.
Yeah. So looking sort of specifically at the first scene, this is quite, it's quite a quiet opening. You have these two lords talking sort of fairly quietly, and sort of there's a bit of a preamble, there's sort of setting the scene, and we're learning about what sort of the situation is at the moment. I mean, is that how your production opens?
It's a really tough first scene because it's sort of scene setter, and again, when you read it, and my own memory of it, having seen it many years ago, is that it's awkward and weird, and you kind of don't listen, and the lords are rather lordly and always sound a bit pompous. But actually, I don't know if it's that. I think it's certainly not in our production. It's when you open. We've been looking at my designer Bill Dudley at sort of a lot of pre-Raphaelite paintings. We are setting it in the 1860s. And a time which, read 1860s, read 1960s.
Right.
And a time where, running away from, say, the Crimean Wars, all the 60s wanted to do with the 1860s was, again, have pleasure and forget about all that. And it's very similar to our 1960s, post-Second World War. So my workshops this week have been, or last week have been, on sort of the morning after, and I've seen it as a permanent party. It's like, I don't know, it's like the Beatles in India, you know, it's this incredible druggy, drinky, beautiful space where you could hang out and love and be free and easy. And in that world, I think all the boundaries have become very rubbed away. It's very egalitarian. You can't see who the servants are. All the lords are mates. All the musicians are lords. There's no upstairs, downstairs. They're all the inner circle. It's like Peter's Friends, that film. Not based on Peter's Friends, the film, but it's just that same thing. Or the Bloomsbury Group, or just to pull on things we might be familiar with.
Yeah.
So it's a very, in that sense, narcissistic. So when we opened, I've been exploring what it's like to wake up with, you know, not the same clothes on, or having lost your car keys, or having vomited in the fruit bowl. And it's a sort of sense of disorientation. Where are you, and where were you when you were last awake? But very, very nice place to be. It's not a gross place to be. But so therefore the two lords are just part of that waking up scene. So when we have lights up, we just have a sleeping beauty set. It looks wildly beautiful, but with some hilarious, if you look closely, you can see that some people are in really extreme places.
Yeah, something's a little bit wrong.
Yeah, so they haven't got the right gear on, or that somebody else is wearing their gear. And so for instance, Archidamus, who's a Bohemian lord, he's had one hell of a day. And it's in the middle, it's really only in the afternoon, so we've got a long way to go. And he's trying to find something which he's, you know, it might be underneath somebody's bottom, I don't know, a pair of glasses. So that first scene is a gradual putting together orientating themselves, getting their clothes, chit-chatting.
So you're slowly sort of introducing the audience in a way to this new place.
Well, and to a party that's gone on for 9 months, and it's actually got to that point where in some ways everybody would quite like it to be over.
Yeah.
And it's all a bit too much.
One of the things, obviously, I suppose, that comes out of sort of that kind of environment is that the relationships become a little bit muddled and twisted. And one of the sort of the first problems of this play is that we've got three characters, Leontes, Hermione and Polixenes, and their relationship has become a bit muddled, and obviously Leontes becomes wildly jealous, and that's sort of where it all begins to go wrong. How are you approaching those three characters? I mean, that sort of love triangle, as it were.
Gosh, there's so many arguments about that. I mean, for instance, for starters, she's, you know, it's innocent. She hasn't done anything. So it is purely of the mind. But on the other hand, it's born out of, I think, permissions that have been granted and have gone on for so long that their intimacy has... It still remains innocent. It's deeply innocent. And that's partly why I'm trying to set it in this kind of idyll, this summer idyll. But because the boundaries have been blurred, and because I think there's a lot of drink and drugs and rock and roll, in some ways it's inevitable that a certain paranoia could emerge. And certainly if you've had repressed in your childhood, which is very clear between him and Polixenes, their friendship is intense. Their twinship is intense from when they were little lads. And somewhere in that is either a loss of identity for Leontes or some deeply repressed insecurity that, given the conditions that he's set up and has asked his wife to do, is to be this beautiful hostess and friend, it's inevitable that it will go wrong. And I've been drawing on a lot of images from, say, Jules et Jim, the Truffaut film, which is just about, again, a friendship where the girl is in a way shared between two men and the trauma and trouble that leads to. But a lot of it, however, is very beautiful about that love triangle.
Yeah.
So I've been looking at the very, very modern context of it, which we can all relate to.
It can make Leontes seem like a real villain, and it can really cast him in a very black light. Is that okay, do you think? Or are you trying to sort of veer away from that and make us see him understand his point of view, I suppose?
Yeah, I think we're trying to... Well, for starters, I'm trying to say that Leontes is a man who's never done this before, and I think, again, often... You know, it only takes you 2 seconds to look at someone and say, oh, well, he's already someone who would be jealous, wouldn't he? But you can't do that. You have to play it. The play is so extraordinary that the first few pages are this utter innocent delight, and you want to be there with them. And then, on a split second, everything changes. And from that moment that jealousy enters, all the egalitarian shit sort of thing goes out the window. And sort of hierarchy enters, fear enters, rage enters, and lives are destroyed. And it is about that terrifying switch from a seeming democracy to a true tyranny. And it is about the power of kingship as well as the terrors of somebody becoming jealous and losing their mind.
We're in scene two now. How do you deal with Mamilius? That's one of the problems that I always find with using children on stage, is that it can be very difficult. I mean, I suppose for you as the director, are you using a child, or are you finding another?
We have a child. We have no idea. I have no idea how I'm going to deal with him, because we haven't got into that stage of rehearsals yet. We're only after week one.
Right.
So we've done quite a bit of work on act one. We're not finished with that even, obviously. So that we know who's playing Mamilius, and the three boys. We have to have three, and they're gorgeous, looking like they're 7-year-olds.
You know? Right.
But the thing about the play is all the triangles within it, and the profound triangle, obviously, is the one at the beginning, which is Leontes, Hermione, and Polixenes. And I make that very, very central. I have them entwined together. Literally, you can't see whose leg or arm belongs to who.
Right.
I'm taking it to its absolute extreme. And it's still innocent. They're still just friends, all in a heap. But the other threesomes are equally profound and disturbing throughout the piece, in the way that triangles are just so difficult. You know, you've got Hermione, the little baby in her tummy, and you've got the boy. And if you've had children, you'll know exactly what that dynamic is. It's a very delicate one. And this baby's going to become another little person. And already that triangle is there when the baby's in your stomach. And then there's a triangle between Leontes, of course, the boy that supplanted him, in a sense, and Hermione. And then you've got another triangle, which is Polixenes, Leontes, and the boy. And whose boy is it? And you've got the later triangle in the second half of the clown and Mopsa and Dorcas, and their intense rivalry over the clown, which is both a parody and a sort of extension, in a way, of the first triangle. So the boy will obviously feature heavily in that. I mean, the other extraordinary thing is the desire of the man to eliminate the heir, which I hadn't known about until I read about this, but now it sort of makes sense in this strange setup where the boy clearly is his son. There was no Polixenes around when he conceived this boy, but he doubts his blood, you know, and he, in some ways it's leading to some kind of desire to kill him, and indeed Mamilius does die.
Do you think that's a kind of jealousy on Leontes' part? Does he see Hermione loving the boy and feel like that's a threat in some way, even though it's his own son?
I don't know if it's ever made that explicit, but certainly the desire to obliterate his family is there. And it seems to spring from this one insecurity which is within him and Polixenes. It doesn't function in text, but there is clearly still this strange rivalry between the little boy who keeps questioning whether he's a boy or a man, and his own manhood, and then the innocence of the child, which he can plainly see, and yet in some ways his suspicion of the child. So
yeah.
Yes, it's there. It's a very modern play in that sense. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, it's difficult because there's obviously this very beautiful speech where he's talking to the boy and questioning himself and asking the boy if he's his son, and you have this very innocent response, yes, of course I am.
Yes.
And that, I feel like the audience is bound to sort of their hearts go out to
yeah.
the child, because he's so vulnerable
yes.
in that way.
And it's scary, just what's going on with this man, yes.
Yeah. One of the other things that I think can be really heartbreaking in this act particularly is the love that you have between Hermione and Leontes, and that is so powerful, and then Hermione is just completely broken when he rejects her. But you don't really have an awful lot of time to show us that being built up and to show them being in love before Leontes turns on that. Do you have a way to deal with that?
Not really. I mean, I'm just, as before, I think I'm just trying to invest as much as I can as a director into those first few moments where you do see the love for each other. I mean, that amazing bit where he says it took her 3 months to open her hand and say yes to him. It's just so beautiful. And she finds it deeply moving, to some degree upsetting for some reason. That's because I think there's already a need there that's sort of bigger than is required for that moment. And she sees how needy he is and vulnerable. But yeah, so I think hopefully we'll have understood something that is then broken. And the problem with the play often is you don't see what's there before it's broken. So you don't know what you're mourning.
Yeah.
You know, you just see a man go violently mad and become horrible, and that isn't right. You've got to be cut up. You've got to be so in pain for Leontes. The man is in such pain at his loss that he feels that he's so shamed and so humiliated and has lost the thing he loves. And in that loneliness, we have to feel, well, we have to feel completely, not completely with him in his actions, but understanding him enough to feel for him.
Mm.
And that's the problem, I think, with the play, is that you just lose empathy and then you just sit and watch him do terrible things.
Yeah, and you don't care.
No, you don't care at all. But you do care for Hermione. She always comes out.
Well, I suppose she comes out spotless, doesn't
she?
She's so virtuous.
Yeah. Not so virtuous, she's just so truthful. She knows what. They'd set up this thing with permission. She said, I strained to do what you asked of me, which was to be a perfect, to be a friend, to take on 9 months. That's all the whole of her pregnancy. We know how hard that is. You know, at all points she had a public duty to do to his friend, and all this entertaining of a lot of people with a lot of money, and, you know, enormous amounts of effort to put on meals. And, you know, the thing would be, it would cost you a lot. In that word she says strange, she means she really worked hard at doing what he asked her to do. And then he, of course, accuses it of being something else. So,
yeah.
You know, we love her for her truth. She's far more intelligent, it seems, and emotionally intelligent as well, than the men around her. And so she's on stage the most attractive. And in those first 6-7 pages, she wins us because she's so utterly alive and incredibly witty and so graceful with her wit. So that's what we mourn, you know, that we see him lose hold of somebody who is, as a play says, so precious.
Yeah. Towards the end of the first act, Leontes and Hermione are gone again, and now we have Camillo and Polixenes on stage just right at the end of the act, and Camillo learns that Leontes thinks that he's betrayed him. Polixenes learns that he's in danger from Leontes, and then sort of throws himself on Camillo's mercy, as it were, and they sort of go off together. How are you dealing with that exit? Because we've only just met Polixenes, now he's leaving again, and it's sort of very sudden.
It's very tricky. Again, I suppose I don't at the moment know that we've only just met Polixenes. You know, it feels to me we've had quite a long time with him. But of course, the play is very rapid. It moves really, really fast. And it's the Camillo figure that is very interesting. I was just saying this morning that he feels to me like he's like waltzing them to Elizabeth. You know, he's immensely powerful. I think people underplay him. You know, they make him some sort of, I don't know, slightly fuddy-duddy, you know, sort of older and affable. I think he runs the joint, and he does it with great cleverness, and no one would know. But I think the kings themselves, Leontes and then later Polixenes and Bohemia, but hardly doesn't really do very much, and it all keeps ticking over. Whilst Camillo has he has got his finger in every pie. He's really on the watch. He's a very careful man. He has control of the army, but it's out of sight. As he says, he has the keys to every postern, he has the keys to every gate. You know, he's a real weight, and therefore, if he is telling you that the king has actually got this irrational obsession, you eventually trust it, because the man is that has been that trustworthy to Leontes. You know, huge history, and is that powerful. He's not a nobody, Camillo.
Mm.
He's not sort of silly. And I feel he's one of them, in the sense that that's something else I've really tried to bring to the table. Everyone's similar ages, you know, they've really grown up together. This party has been a great party of mates. Camillo's come slightly differently. It's like he's come from the state sector, not the private schools. But even so, he joined that party early. So that sort of knowledge and familiarity is really there.
I want to skip very naughtily out of the first act, because one of the things that has always troubled me most about the play is Hermione's death, and the fact that we meet her and then she has this sort of very ceremonial dying, and then at the end of the play we meet her again, and I always find that must be so difficult for an actress. Have you sort of got a way in your head that works, that makes sense, and to give that a truth?
Well, we don't know if she does die, does she?
Well, maybe. Maybe not.
Maybe not. I mean, I think it has to work on two levels. I think in the Pandosto, she dies, and then Shakespeare obviously writes a story based on that story written by Green, Pandosto, and brings her to life again. And instead of the king committing suicide, they come back together, and it's an amazing moment where he decides that this isn't a tragedy, but it's going to move into another place. For me, I think it works on all those different levels. That yes, she has died. Yes, you think the king is going to go into this sort of, he's cast himself out of office. He's going to become a hermit and pray to the gods for forgiveness, and he will go on doing that, and flagellating and eating nothing and praying for this salvation, which will never come unless the daughter is found. I've lost my way there. That's a really good point. Oh yeah, so on that level, that's what we believe. That is the story. But in my version, in my head as well, you feel that this incredible thing happens when the sort of the storms happen when she dies and the boy has died and the Apollo is angry and the sea is a big presence for me in this production, and the sea becomes angry, and something of that anger and rage is Leontes's rage. And in a way, that sea and his rage consumes the whole world.
Right.
At that point, everything dies. And then, of course, out of this appalling emptiness comes one little cry, and that's the baby's cry. And when I read the play, I thought, ooh, when the baby cries, of course Hermione would come alive, because you'd hear her baby cry.
Yeah.
Of course, you don't see that at all, but it's somewhere that's how the play operates. It operates both on a real level. Actually, she's not dead. She's been looked after by her Paulina. We know that later. But at this point, we don't know that. And the play does operate on these mythical levels, deep, deep sort of faith levels as well. There is no God, there is a God. You know, and nature can start again, even if there's a wasteland, even if there's a nuclear bomb, it will all come back. There will be a little green shoot that will say, you know, life comes on, it has to keep going. There will be a bloodline. It's a huge thing in the play, that the loss of an heir is the loss of a king, loss of a way forward. You know, it's much more than we would make of it now. It's just a bit like hearing Kate Middleton's pregnant, you know, the whole world, oh, what is she? But it's a really deep thing, that, in terms of Shakespeare's day, you know, the lack of an heir for Queen Elizabeth. Of course, at the time it was written, it was King James, but you know, that was an enormous question for the nation, and it's an enormous question for the play. If you kill your children, that's it.
Yeah, thank you very much.